worth less than somebody else's. Thank you.
Businesses have a responsibility throughout their entire value chains to respect human rights. If you can apply pressure at the top of the supply chain strategically, then you can achieve change at the bottom.
You are listening to Radio Atticus,
your national program on the law in the name of social justice.
This is obviously a live issue and we need to start to talk about how we might regulate it here that we aren't outsourcing our problems.
People are curious, they look at you and they want to know your story.
Radio Atticus, more than the vibe.
Hello and welcome to your national program, which tackles the law and justice and how it impacts your daily life. I'm Anne-Marie Reyes, your host, hoping to take this journey with you. In this edition, we go deeper into syllogism of the legal kind, Radio Atticus' coverage of what goes behind our learning about the law. And it's about syllogism, the logic behind how legal decisions are made and why we need to learn it. But before that, news reached us about hundreds of charities revoked by the national regulator, Australian Charities and Not-for-Profits Commission, or ACNC. We find out about that shortly. Australians are one of the most generous givers to charities around the world. But do they realise that of late, 590 charities have had their registration revoked by the Australian Charities and Not-for-Profits Commission, or ACNC. And Assistant Commissioner Marie Baird says it's simply because they've not updated with their annual reporting obligations as a registered charity. I caught up with Commissioner Baird to get more details.
To get onto the Australian Charities Register, a charity has to demonstrate that it has a charitable purpose and that it has appropriate governance, and it must agree to file an annual information statement to keep the register up to date. A charity has 6 months after the end of its financial year to lodge its annual information statement. Effectively, that statement checks what they're doing, it gives a little bit of financial information, and it confirms who their directors are. And if they fail to lodge that, we send out a notice asking them to lodge their annual information statement. If they fail to lodge their annual information statement 2 years in a row, we give them a notice saying we will take them off the register if they're unable to file. And so recently we've removed 590 charities from the register because they had not filed for 2 years.
Why is it taking so long for them to file? Have they explained any reason at all?
Many of them may simply have lost steam or gone out of business or not feel that they need to be registered anymore. As any business, the charities come and go, and some of them do decide that they're no longer operating. So these are the ones who don't give us any explanation. By definition, they're the ones who don't answer any notices.
Is the requirement for them to produce annual information statements, is that within the regulations or the law of the country?
Yes, that's right at the heart of the ACNC Act, is the idea of a public register of charities. So that's a statute, and charities who are on the register must simply file so the register is always up to date. And if the public look at the register, they want to know that it's accurate and that it's up to date.
Why should I be worried about checking a charity being on that register?
The vast majority of charities are doing the right thing and they are doing good things. But from time to time, organisations either on the register or who claim to be charities do behave in a way that is outside community expectations. Perhaps the money is going into private pockets. Perhaps they're wasting money, or perhaps there's no one really in control of the charity. So in those circumstances, we look into the situation. The register is a way of the public checking to see if a charity is genuine and whether it's up to date with its filing and whether it's being supervised by the regulator.
In the history since, I think, 2012 when the Act was introduced, has it been just mainly about charities not lodging their information statements regularly that's been the problem?
Yes, in the initial stages, we received a list that had been building up over the years of what the tax office thought were charities at the time, but that list hadn't been revised for a number of years. So in that first couple of years, we were really sorting out who was still there, who was still operating, then over time, who was prepared to file each year
How do we compare to other countries at the moment in terms of the other side, how charities conduct themselves?
Public trust and confidence in charities in Australia is very high and much higher than in other countries. In fact, if we ask people a series of questions as to who they trust most, they will talk about professions such as doctors as a trusted organisation. And near the top of that list, they will say, and we trust charities, that when we give to charity, they will do the right thing.
Can you think of one of the most difficult problems that you've had with a charity, and how was that dealt with and how is it now?
The greatest temptation, I think, in a charity is that the people who run the charity, if there's no supervision, can start to run the charity for their own benefit rather than the benefit of the people they serve. And so on occasions, we find that the money is not going to the charitable purpose, but is going into the pocket of the usually a very small number of people running the charity. So in those circumstances, we'll step in and say, you must get your books in order. You must ensure that the money is being applied to a charitable purpose. And you must make sure that you take no more than is reasonable for the administration of the charity.
In terms of the way a charity operates, how different is it from a club, your normal club, or like an incorporated organisation?
A charity can be any form of organisation. For example, it can be an incorporated association, it can be a company, it can be a trust, it can be an unincorporated association. The form is not the important thing. It's whether they carry out a charitable purpose. The main charitable purposes are education, welfare, religion, the human rights, the environment, the arts. So there are a series of recognised charitable purposes. One interesting example is that sport is not a charitable purpose. That's seen as recreational. And so that's outside charity. And so if you look at all not-for-profit associations in Australia, some people say there's about 600,000 of them, but only 55,000 are charities.
Very interesting. So we usually hear comments like it's a tax-deductible charity. What does that mean?
Around about half of the charities have got tax deductibility. It means that they can offer their donors a tax-deductible receipt and the donor can offset that against their own income. There are some sorts of charities that get tax deductibility, and there are some sorts of charities that don't. For example, religious charities generally don't get tax deductibility. Schools generally don't get tax deductibility. Welfare organisations, environmental organisations, and arts organisations do get tax deductibility. So it depends which sort of charity you are, whether you can offer a tax-deductible receipt to donors.
Are you able to explain why the difference?
Really, it's just over the years, the Australian Parliament have decided that they want to encourage giving in particular to certain causes. So, for example, for a long time, welfare organisations and overseas aid organisations have been regarded as organisations that deserve particularly the public's support. And so they've been given tax deductibility. Environmental organisations, arts organisations, really the government says they deserve greater support, and so they're given tax deductibility. The very existence of a charities commission means that we can encourage good charities, we can raise public trust and confidence, and one other thing we do is we want to cut red tape for charities. We want to cut out the burden of lots of different government requirements to one charity commission. We can provide that information to other government departments. So it's public trust and confidence, it's healthy trusted charities, and it's less red tape.
If you donate and a charity giver, you might want to check out the link for charities who've lost their registration on acnc.gov.au/double defaulters. You're listening to Radio Atticus, broadcast nationally to the Community Radio Network and produced in the studios of Radio 2SER. I'm Anna-Marie Reyes.
I'm Michael Kirby, and you are listening to Radio Atticus. Radio Atticus is part of the Community Radio Network. I was formerly a Justice of the High Court of Australia with no time to listen to this, but now I sit glued to Radio Atticus.
Just Words was 2SER's first original podcast series, looking at Section 18C of the Racial Discrimination Act, and that's a part of the law that makes it illegal to offend, insult, humiliate, or intimidate someone based on their race. We spoke to the people who have used 18C and the people who have had it used against them. Just Words is now wrapped, and you can catch up on all the episodes and podcast extras. Search for Just Words on iTunes or your favourite podcast app. Stay tuned for even more original podcast series from 2SER 107.3.
Are you able to just explain very generally at this stage, what's the general application of legal syllogism?
Do you want me to just start from the syllogism itself? Because that one is what we do every day. It's like, you know, deduction, where we reach a certain conclusion after we have a series of steps that we follow in our thinking. For example, if we were going to talk about, well, we want to work out if somebody's cheating on someone, right? You could start off by your first premise would be that your husband or your wife always comes home at a certain time. Let's say comes home at 8 o'clock at night, Monday to Friday. And then the next premise would be, well, they haven't been coming home, you know, at that time for the last couple of weeks. So the conclusion there from our deductive, very simple deductive process is that something is happening outside of home to your husband or wife. That's a simple deduction that we make every day about, you know, about ourselves. Now, for the legal syllogism, it's a similar process, except the process is much more complicated because your first premise, which is the major premise, would have to be grounded, as we call it. It would have to be based on evidence, on facts. It would have quite stringently. And the next premise, which is the minor premise, which is the application of the circumstances to the principle that you find in the major premise. The major premise being, you know, the legal principle that you want to follow for a certain part of your case.
Co-author of the new book, which tackles legal syllogism, Annabeth DiCerto there, who opened the topic of the logic behind the law and how we should all be learning about this. Without it, you might find it hard to make sense of certain legal decisions. Now we continue on to part two of our coverage of legal syllogism, this time with primary author Kenneth Yin from the School of Business and Law at Edith Cowan University. Thank you so much for coming to our forum here at the lovely moot court. I'm surrounded by students to discuss with Ken this new book as well as Annabeth, who you already heard on the program previously as part one of our story on legal syllogism.
My name is very much for that Ms. Rees. The book is called Legal Problem Solving and Syllogistic Analysis. I lecture at Edith Cowan University at the School of Business and Law. It's my pleasure to talk to you about a new book that I've done that's just by LexisNexis. The fundamental idea of the book is that Aristotle many years ago taught the idea of the syllogism as being the foundation of all logic. Were to imagine that you could divide every logical argument into a syllogism and use that same logic to create a legal argument, then that essentially is the core of the book.
I might just hear some impressions from the forum here. I believe you're all students.
Yes.
So I'll just ask a little question about why did you do this course?
Just studying legal research and writing with Ken, and the idea of being given the tools to solve problems is very useful as a legal student. I think Annabeth and Ken, we owe them a great debt of gratitude because the IRAC process did have gaps. The main methodology we used to solve problems when we studied law was very rudimentary in a sense. So what they've done is refined it in this book, and that's really helpful.
Yeah, like she said, the first time I saw the book, it was, I think I was a bit nervous to open it. It looked, it was confronting because I'm from an IT background. We write to inform in IT, but in law you write to argue a point. So I think it's been quite helpful.
Annabeth, can you just let me know a little bit about your background again?
My background is studies in sociology and political economy and also education. And my honours is in Asian political economy. You have to provide the tools for the students to use in terms of how to use the concepts, the legal concept. In this case, how to use the syllogism. So that's his material.
the book Ken, what was the inspiration behind you deciding to put this together?
It actually all began when I was walking my dog, who was a Labrador. And someone said to me, your Labrador must be friendly because a Labrador. And it just happened that day that I had just taught a class of contract students. And I realized that what the gentleman had said to me about the Labrador was very much similar to the way that some of my contract students had tried to express an argument rather bad. I tried to write a book based on the way that you would express a generalization, which is a rule of law, that generalization is actually argued, leading to the conclusion, which was very much the way that Aristotle many years ago had taught people how syllogistic thought was to have been expressed. Like this, if you then took the argument one step further and argued that most Labradors are friendly, but Labradors which have been the subject of inbreeding and abuse are not necessarily friendly, and then you asked two people to argue whether a particular Labrador was likely to be friendly or not, that comes very close to the core of reasoning, because a person may well say most Labradors which have been the subject of inbreeding and the subject of abuse are not necessarily friendly.
I would venture that the major premise there is that all Labradors are friendly dogs, but that Labradors that have been subject to inbreeding and abuse are not friendly. That's the major premise.
So, Ken, is this the sort of reaction you got when you actually started introducing this? Because I understand you were testing this among your students.
That's right. And if you were to ask them if they were to try to increase the degree of certainty as to whether their Labrador is likely to be friendly or not, they would have to perform something that's quite analogous to the legal research that they do in class. They go to a book and on Labradors and or dogs generally.
For educators, for lecturers, what is the challenge, you think? Annie-Beth.
Well, my part in the book was an analysis of the teaching process and the pedagogy and the materials that Ken had provided for his students as supplementary materials, and also for lecturers teaching logical thinking and legal problem solving. You have to have logical scaffolding. Okay, you need to teach in stages. You'd need to provide some real life examples. You know, in teaching, you have to relate the concepts that you teach to something that students can identify with in terms of their own everyday life.
Now, let's move into IRAC.
Issue, rule, application, and conclusion.
Is IRAC used in general with, like, the study of law?
Yes.
Okay. It's pivotal to the study of law and to arguing cases or points of law. Syllogism and IRAC gives us a framework or a scaffolding with which to frame our argument in a logical, rational way. And we go from simple examples and it gets more complex as we go along. And the book helps to reaffirm that.
The idea is that the blueprint for the understanding of IRAC itself would have been through an understanding of the syllogism, and vice versa. It was only through an understanding of the syllogism that one actually acquires anything like a workable understanding of IRAC. There wasn't a lot of material in Australian pedagogy that actually addressed the question of how to approach IRAC. There's a lot of American material written on this, but not first year, and my students are really worthy first-year students. One of the most useful definitions I came across was written by numerous American authors, in which they said that IRAC was essentially the legal variant of the syllogism, which really led me to the idea that the blueprint for the understanding of IRAC itself would have been through an understanding of the syllogism, and vice versa. It was only through an understanding that one actually acquires anything like a workable understanding of IRAC. That really is the entire core of the book.
All right. So from that then, talking about IRAC and syllogism, I might just check in with Annie-Beth. When it's taught in the classroom, do you usually give resources to understand where IRAC and syllogism sits,
in Kent's materials for the last 7 years. Teaches syllogistic thinking first, as you would use it in everyday life. He has a very good example about the man in the balloon. You know, you probably haven't heard of that. But I gave my example as the one about the unfaithful husband. Always comes home at a certain time, and he has his dinner, right, Monday to Friday, happening for 2 or 3 years like this, because you're newly married, and then one day he doesn't come home on time. Like, he starts coming home at different times, and finally one day he comes home with lipstick on his lapel here. Okay, so then our principle is, my husband always comes home at a certain time, that's a major premise, and therefore that means, you know, he's okay, he's loyal, he's faithful, right? And then the circumstances suddenly change. The circumstances are that, oh no, he's come home at different times of the week and he's got lipstick on his lip or something. So something has changed. So maybe the conclusion is there's something happening. Mm. Okay. And then you do a mental syllogism, another syllogism, to then work out what is happening to him, what has happened to my marriage or my relationship, right? So Ken balloon.
I like the example of the man in the balloon because it had a lawyer in it somewhere. So it went a bit like this. He was in the hot air balloon. He was 40 feet above the ground. He is lost. He then asks someone on the ground, yells out, "Where am I?" And the man on the ground says, "You're in a hot air balloon 40 feet above the ground." And the man in the hot air balloon says, "You must be a lawyer." And the man on the ground says, "Yes, I am a lawyer, but how did you know?" And the man in the hot air balloon says, "Because everything you've told me is entirely useless, entirely accurate, and stuff I already know." Now, what I then do to the class is to say to them, "Well, you know, could you create a generalization, how that generalization is applied and what conclusions arise from that?" And part of the discussion then surrounds the weakness and fallacies of that reasoning. It doesn't take much difficulty being prompted to do so to come to the view that the question that's being asked is the man on the ground a lawyer? The major premise, now that we know what we're talking about, or the generalization then follows: all lawyers tell me things I already know. Tell me is utterly useless, but also entirely accurate.
Therefore, using the balloon example, does your major premise need to be really tight and robust?
Well, yes and no. Again, the lawyer has absolutely no excuse for avoiding arguing a case based on limited knowledge of the law. What he tries as far as possible to do is to find as many parallels as possible to the factual situation at hand.
All right, so let's then tease out the man with an affair example. Say, for example, the affair got worse, meaning the relationship continued. The husband turns up at home and finds the wife has died. Before she actually died, she went to a restaurant and had some food there and then got home. The only information that the husband got. So if we're going to apply AC framework, what are some of the things that you'd pick up from that?
Because you have two issues to work out, how she died and if he's having it. So you'd separate it. You separate the facts and put them into their own IRACs. Mm. So the first one would be the issue, and then men who come home with lipstick on their lapels normally have an affair. And then he has come home, like your application would be, he has come home with lipstick on his lapel. Conclusion, he is having an affair. So that's one issue done. And then the next issue is how she's died. Two separate issues. And two IRACs.
I might just get Ken to respond to that. Ken?
Yes, actually, that's absolutely correct, but I do not know this example. Did you just make it up? Oh, good. That puts me on the spot as well. But there is, in fact, a third possibility. Thank you very much. And it's this. There is actually a third issue, really, is why has she died? And you may have a major premise that a wife or who has become aware that her husband has been having an affair is likely to react quite violently. You may well have three separate syllogisms arising out of this scenario. So the one that's missing is we've got in Fem's example, you've got the how, but not the why.
Okay, so stepping back again, Ken,
Can you direct me, Ken, and perhaps some of you that have read parts of it, a section in the book you threw, if there's too many issues here.
A really useful chapter is chapter 6, because Ken goes through rule identification as well, but also the fact that you can have a meta-syllogism, and within that meta-syllogism you can have mini-syllogisms. So often in a legal exam or assignment, if you're trying to solve an issue, like for a hypothetical client, you often have several issues to deal with concurrently, and you have to address those issues concurrently, and sometimes they compete as well. So
finally, I will conclude about the online resources. Tell us a little bit about the section, how it complements the use of the book and the learnings from.
Well, chapter 7 is basically educational philosophy. It's an analysis, as I said before, of the teaching process and the pedagogy, as in, which basically reflect the best practice of what constructivism is, educational philosophy, where you interact with your students, you give them feedback, you scaffold what they're learning.
We tried to do that now.
That's what the book illustrates. That's what Ken has been doing for the last 7 years with his legal students. The book meets that. It's best practice in terms of this constructivism, which is a way of teaching and thinking about teaching. Chapter 8 is much more complex, and it's was really, really challenging for me to write because, as you know, I'm not a trained legal practitioner. But what Chapter 8 shows is that the attack on the legal syllogism by realist and pragmatist, particular movement in jurisprudence, in legal philosophy, is based on false premises, as we can say. I have refuted about 6 lines of their attack. And as an illustration, for example, the realists and pragmatists say, problem with the uncertainty of law. Like, if you apply the legal syllogism, you're not sure that you're going to come out with the conclusion that you want. You're not sure you're going to win the case. Basically, I refute that by looking again at legal philosophy, primarily from a fellow called Neil McCormick. He's a famous Scottish legal expert and historian scholar, where he has shown that the law is about defeasible certainty. There is uncertainty in the law, certainty. That's because every time you've won a legal argument, you can be challenged. One way that I've basically rebutted that line of attack, but there's a few interesting chapter to write, because it basically shows that the legal syllogism must exist, and we cannot do without it. It's a legal framework. It's a way of thinking. It's a toolbox, as you've called it. Without the legal syllogism, we basically fall into incoherence and inconsistency in the practice of law. And I'm really scared that I'm probably going to get a whole spate of counter-challenges from realists and pragmatists. But it was very, very interesting to write it for Ken.
I think one would welcome the debate as much as possible, because whatever happens to Annabeth, there are people on her side, and there may well be people who oppose that view, and she's just added a particularly exciting dimension. I'm not particularly concerned about the conclusion of that. I do expect and hope that there will be those who detract from that view, because it does add to a healthy and lively debate. The bottom line, to coin a cliche, is that irrespective of what the philosophers other than Annabeth might think, is that as far as first years are concerned, the system does work, and that's something which we would find difficult to refute. And one of the reasons why that is difficult to refute is because even if there are deeper layers of analysis and sophistication that might come with later learning, without the syllogistic foundation in first year law, more senior law students might find it difficult even to confront the more sophisticated layers of analysis that might be demanded of them subsequently. So even at its very, very worst, the learning of fundamental syllogistic logic in first year, in my view at least, is crucial.
Ken Yin is the main author of the book Legal Problem Solving and Syllogistic Analysis, a guide for foundation law students, and ending that interview. Watch this space as we go even deeper into part 3 of legal syllogism in our next coverage. You're listening to Radio Atticus, broadcast nationally to the Community Radio Network and produced in the studios of Radio 2SER. And that's about all for this week's edition. I hope you enjoyed our stories. If you want more, check out our online podcast on www.2ser.com/radioatticus. A shout out on the country.